Listening Library presents The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing, Traitor to the Nation, Volume 2, The Kingdom on the Waves, by M.T. Anderson. Read for you by Peter Francis James. Argument of the First Volume. The boy Octavian is raised in a gaunt house by men engaged in mysterious pursuits. It is revealed that the men of the house are philosophers, pursuing subtle knowledge of the arts and sciences, calling themselves the Novanglian College of Lucidity. Novanglian, for the house is located in the New England colonies, in the town of Boston. Lucidity, for it is an age when enlightenment illumines every corner of the unknown. The eccentricities of that college are many. The boy Octavian's mother will not tell him of why he must live there, or why she is constrained as often as she is. The reader is made acquainted with two of Octavian's friends, a slave named Pro Bono, and Octavian's tutor, Dr. Trefusis. Through hints by these savant gentlemen and examination of his circumstances, Octavian realizes the nature of his situation. He is the subject of a great experiment in which the scholars of the College of Lucidity seek to determine whether the capacities of the African are equal to those of the European. Accordingly, Octavian has received instruction in all of the gentle arts, in the deepest sciences, and is an excellent Latinist. The College of Lucidity, having suffered some financial embarrassment, pro bono is given to a potential investor as a gift. As the colonies resist taxation by the crown, the tumults of war press themselves upon the college. Adding to the distresses of the age, the smallpox threatens the beleaguered city. Fearing disease, a revolt by the slaves, and a myriad of other destructive eventualities, the scholars of the college flee Boston and establish quarantine in the countryside, where they inoculate all of their party against the pox. Something goes amiss with the inoculation, and several members of the party suffer the full agonies of the disease. The disease proves fatal to Octavian's mother. Dumbfounded by the scene of horror he discovers when he seeks to pay his last respects to her, Octavian flees the College of Lucidity. He takes refuge with the rebels, aiding in the fortification of the countryside as Boston, now a fastness for the king's army, is besieged by the patriots. One of the patriots, without knowledge, betrays our hero to an agent of the College of Lucidity, and the boy is again captured. Taken back to the house in the countryside, he defies his former masters. With the aid of his tutor, Dr. Trefusis, he escapes, leaving the masters of the college drugged and insensate. Dr. Trefusis and Octavian, now under fear of a sentence of death, flee towards the city and the king's camp, where they might find safety. Octavian muses on who, the king's forces or the rebels, offers the greater hope of freedom to him and his fellow Africans, embonded in the new world. Part 5. The Theater of War. Drawn from the manuscript testimony of Octavian Gitney. From Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan. Persona, in Latin, signifies the disguise, or outward appearance of a man, counterfeited on the stage, and sometimes more particularly that part of it which disguiseth the face as a mask or vizard, so that a person is the same that an actor is, both on the stage and in common conversation, and to personate is to act, or represent himself, or another. The rain poured from the heavens as we fled across the mud flats, that scene of desolation. It soaked through our clothes and bit at the skin with its chill. It fell hard and ceaseless from the heavens, as the deluge that had both inundated Deucalion and buoyed up Noah. And as with that deluge, we knew not whether it fell as an admonition for our sins, or as the promise of a brighter, newly washed morning to come. I left all that I knew behind me. Though the ways of the College of Lucidity were strange to the world, and the habits of its academicians eccentric, they were familiar to me, and I traded them now for uncertainty and strife. Though I returned indeed to Boston, that town best known to me, its circumstances were changed, now that it was the seat of the king's army, and sat silent and brooding in the bay. We knew not what we would find therein. Dr. Trefusis and I stumbled across the ribbed sand, treading through seaweed mounded in pools. We slithered and groped, that we might retain our footing, and on occasions we fell, Dr. Trefusis's hands bleeding from the roughness of rock and incision of barnacles. We wound through the meanders that led between stubbled mudbanks in no straight or seemly course. I pulled Dr. Trefusis out of the ditches where water still ran over the silt. We crawled over knolls usually submerged by the bay. At some point, soaked, he shed his coat. After a time, there was no feature but the sand, corrugated with the action of the tides. We made our way across a dismal plain, groping for detail, sight obscured. But that morning I had been a prisoner, a metal mask upon my face, and my jowls larded with my own vomit, in a condition which could hardly have been more debased. But that morning I had watched the masters of my infancy and youth writhe upon the floor and fall into unpitied slumber, perhaps their bane. A sentence of death might already rest upon my head. The thought of this plagued me, the memory of those bodies on the floor, bound with silken kerchiefs, and I found I could not breathe and wished to run faster, that I might recover my breath. Tumbling through the darkness of those flats, revolving such thoughts amidst utter indistinctness, I feared I would never again find myself. All I knew was lost and sundered from me. I knew not any more what actuated me. We ran on through the night, across the sand, and it was as Dr. Trefusis had always avowed in his sparkish philosophy, that there was no form nor matter, that we acted our lives in an emptiness decorated with an empty show of substance and a darkness infinite behind it. Forms and figures loomed out of the rain, boulders in our path, gruesome as ogres to my susceptible wits, hulking, pocked and eyed with limpets, shaggy with weeds. We came upon a capsized dinghy in the mud, mostly rotted, and barrels half sunk. My aged companion now leaned upon my shoulder as we walked, his breath heavy in his chest. Once I started with terror at a ratcheting upon my foot, to find a horseshoe crab trundling past in search of a pool, its saber tail and lobed armor grotesque in the extreme. Dr. Trefusis, wheezing, greeted it. "Old friend!" His amiability to the crab, I feared, was merely a pretense to stop our running. He did not seem well. We could no longer detect the city. The night was so black, so full of water and motion, so unsparing was the drench. Our senses disorganized, our frames trembling with cold, we calculated as best we could the direction of our town and made our way across that countryside of dream. Once I was shown by the scholars of the college a rock, spherical in shape, which, when chiseled open, revealed a tiny cavern of crystal, and they told me that these blunt stones often held such glories, that though some were filled only with dust, others, when broken open, enwombed the skeletons of dragons or of fish, beaked like birds. Thus I felt in approaching my city, that place which seemed known stone, but which, when riven after its long gestation, might contain either wonders or ash or the death in infancy of some clawed terror. We found ourselves at the brink of the returning tide. We walked through it without notice, so thick was the very air with water, until the flood reached Dr. Trefusis's knees, and there he halted, swaying. "I cannot continue," said he. "I will return to shore." Thus his offer. But well did I know that he had no intention of returning to the bank, and could not, unassisted, did he wish to. I was aware that if I...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?